back foot. They're facing a desperate manpower shortage and deep fatigue among their soldiers.
Okay, so let's look forward. What are Ukrainians saying about the next stage of this war?
Yeah, you know, there are growing doubts about support from allies. On Monday, the Biden administration announced another $2.5 billion in military aid. But President-elect Donald Trump will be sworn in January 20th. Trump's promised to push for a quick end to this war, and he's voiced ambivalence about supporting Ukraine's war effort. And then there's a second huge question here: how or if Ukraine can muster more soldiers for its exhausted army. And that all adds up to deep uncertainty. I spoke last night with Yaroslav Mishkov. He's 24 years old.
I think I do not have a lot of hopes. Maybe that Ukraine will be existing next year, and that will be great. And that my friends will be alive, that would be great too.
So there's a lot of pessimism here, especially among young people I've been talking to. Mishkov told me one of his best friends had just been conscripted into the army. So this New Year's, he and his friends weren't celebrating.
Sobering his wishes just to exist next year. NPR's Brian Mann in Kyiv. Thank you, Brian.
Thank you.
In this country, Democrats are asking how they can do better in the next election. One of their rising leaders feels he knows why progressives lost the working class. Congressman Greg Kassar represents parts of Austin and San Antonio, Texas, and now at age 35, he will lead the House Progressive Caucus, which includes more famous figures like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Greg Kassar wants his party to change its approach.
I started out as a 24-year-old running for city council. I had been a labor organizer before that, and on construction sites where our job was to organize workers, whether they had been fifth-generation Texans coming from majority white unions to Spanish-speaking workers who had just immigrated here. The way that we recognize the cultural divides on a construction site are the same way that I think the Democratic Party needs to address those divides, where you can't ignore the differences of people's views, what they care about, where they're coming from, but you could bring everybody together around fighting for one thing, and that was a raise, getting a fairer deal at work.
Are you telling me that you might find people on a construction site who are Catholic and more conservative and oppose abortion rights? Or maybe they're the children of immigrants, but they have a problem with illegal immigration. People like that, but you still want to appeal to them on other issues?
What I've found is the vast majority of people on that construction site want to see everybody treated decently, and they want to make sure that they and their coworkers all get a raise, that the construction site is safe. Not just because they want their coworkers to be safe on the construction site, but if somebody else is in an unsafe situation, that could hurt you. Those basics are what brought together the FDR coalition and the JFK coalition and the Democratic Party. That's how Texas Democrats maintained control of this state for so long, up until around the time that I was born. And I think we've got to find a way to get back to that. You don't have to throw vulnerable people under the bus to do it.
Now, somebody listening to this who followed the presidential campaign that Democrats lost might say, hey, wait a minute. Democrats had a whole list of proposals and programs that would lower people's costs, that would give them an opportunity to raise, that would support unions and a lot of other things. And I'm wondering if you're telling me something else. Are you telling me that Democrats lacked some larger narrative as to what all of those programs added up to?
The Democrats have a big narrative problem. We have some substance problems I also want to talk about, but narrative, that Trump GOP had a clear narrative. The Democrats need a narrative that says it wasn't a trans person that denied your health insurance claim. It was a giant corporate insurance company that's gone deregulated by the Republicans. Democrats needed to have a narrative that said, an asylum seeker isn't jacking up your rent. In fact, it is a Wall Street hedge fund that's buying up all these houses that's jacking up your rent. And it's those Wall Street hedge fund CEOs that Trump is putting in charge of his cabinet.
I wonder if there is one way that Democrats did participate in the culture wars in a way that harmed them politically, because we're in a democracy and everybody who's an adult almost has a vote. And it seems that Democrats were perhaps a little more willing to say, if you don't have my view of race, social justice, policing, trans rights, a lot of other things, you're out. I don't want you.
The Democratic Party has to make sure, both in message and in substance, that whether you agree with us on every issue or not, you're welcome to be in the party. We have to have a tent big enough that includes people across geography, across race, and across ideological views. I have in my district more conservative voters that voted for Donald Trump or Greg Abbott and still even voted for me as a very progressive Democrat. We're here to add more people to our community, to our party. We can stand strong for our values, but realize that politics is a game of addition, not of subtraction.
Did Republicans do a better job of adding in 2024, by which I mean finding new voters, people who rarely vote or never vote, and getting them on their side?
Republicans were able to bring more working class people into their coalition. So many people that just say, look, all the parties are the same. What's the point of participating in all of this? We need to show those people that we're different.
One other thing, is it possible we're just overanalyzing the 2024 election? The fact is that people have voted again and again and again against whoever is in power in not quite all, but most of the elections since the financial crisis?
Since the financial crisis, the Democratic Party has slowly been losing its share of working class voters. So we aren't overanalyzing it around just this one election. And the other piece of this is that since the financial crisis, there has been unrest in the American electorate. Think about it. You've got the Tea Party movement, Occupy Wall Street, Black Lives Matter. People have been upset with the political system not working out the way that it is supposed to. We've got to be the party of saying, we're going to make sure democracy works for you and not just the people with lobbyists and with money.
Congressman Greg Cazar of Texas was just reelected to a second term in the House of Representatives, where he will also lead the House Progressive Caucus, the youngest ever member to do so. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
If beer is your drink of choice, your libations are less likely to come from a craft brewery.
Yeah, last year, after almost 20 years of explosive growth in the craft beer industry, more U.S. breweries closed than opened. The Brewers Association tracked 335 new openings and nearly 400 closings.
I think the biggest challenge for breweries right now is standing out.
That's Bart Watson, incoming president and CEO of the Brewers Association.
You know, you go back a few years and we were getting 1,200 to 1,400 brewery openings a year, which was unprecedented. So breweries have to find reason for beer drinkers to visit them or pick their beer off shelves, which have a lot of great options these days.
Successful breweries are trying to reach a wider customer base by leaning into the non-alcoholic market, expanding to become general beverage companies, and becoming more visible in their local communities.
I think the demand for craft beer really stemmed for three things: for flavor, for variety, and for a set of values around local, independent, and just the companies themselves. And, you know, they've really succeeded in their mission to change the beer industry. We have a lot of flavor and variety right now, and that's the competitive challenge that brewers face in a world with lots of flavor and variety. How do you now stand out?
Watson says the slowdown does not mark the end of craft breweries, and he's doing his part to support the breweries he likes.
I'm in Florida right now, so I'm enjoying a lot of the what they call Florida Vice beers, kind of, you know, light sours with fruit in them. And when I get back to Colorado, I'm sure I'm going to be enjoying a lot of darker beers that fit with the season there.
Watson says, like with all local businesses, the way to keep them alive is to go in and buy the products. Happy New Year.
Cheers.
This is NPR News.
And this is Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. Thanks for being with us on this first day of 2025. We're still following the latest out of New Orleans, where police say that a person drove a truck through a crowd of people on Bourbon Street, killing 10 people and injuring more than 30, before getting out and shooting two police officers. The latest on that coming up in news at about 8:30. Plus, Wisconsin Life coming up in 25 minutes on WPR.
If you know a Christmas carol, the chimes will ring a few bells. Poor old Trotty Veck has lost his faith in humanity, and he believes that his poverty is the result of his unworthiness. On New Year's Eve, he is visited by spirits who restore his faith and show him that nobody is born evil, but rather that crime and poverty are things created by man. Join us for The Chimes tonight at 9:30 on Chapter a Day.
Support for WPR comes from tens of thousands of donors. Your investment makes research-based journalism, interesting conversations, and quality entertainment possible. On air, on the app, and at WPR.org. Thank you.
The kickoff of the 25th anniversary of Gene's Jazz on January 4th features Amy Mack performing with a trio of seasoned veterans of the jazz scene. On the second half of the show, Septesosaurus, seven venerable giants of the local music scene, take over. For more info and tickets, visit RacineTheater.org.
Wisconsin Public Radio. In weather, mostly cloudy today. A few flurries to start the day, with high temperatures reaching the 20s and 30s. Overnight, it's going to get cold. Lows down into the single digits and teens across the state. And tomorrow, a mix of sunshine and clouds. A chance for lake effect snow in the north, with high temperatures in the 20s. This is WPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Americans United for Separation of Church and State. For more than 75 years, AU has supported freedom without favor and equality without exception. Learn more at au.org/NPR. From the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, dedicated to improving the learning experience for America's students by sharing what works in pre-K through 12 education at edutopia.org. From Imaginable Futures, celebrating the hard work, commitment, and achievements of the 1 in 5 college students who are parents. More at imaginablefutures.com. And from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. This New Year's Day is Public Domain Day. As with each January 1st, some old copyrighted works enter the public domain, meaning the copyright expires and anybody can use them. This year's works include this classic.
I'm singing in the rain, just singing in the rain.
That version appeared in an early talkie film, The Hollywood Review of 1929. The Gene Kelly version of this song is a little newer and still protected. That's because, for the most part, the items that lose their copyright are just a day over 95 years old, items from 1929. Jennifer Jenkins loves this stuff. She is co-director of Duke University's Center for the Study of the Public Domain. Works from 1929, what is entering the public domain?
Okay, I will give you my total top ones. There's some literary masterpieces that you probably had to read in high school or in college. They include Ernest Hemingway's A Farewell to Arms.
Oh, great.
Yeah, William Faulkner's The Sound and the Fury.
Ah.
Virginia Woolf's A Room of One's Own. And then from the hard-boiled detective genre, the very first appearance of the Maltese Falcon, which was serialized in a magazine called Black Mass Magazine.
That's really something. Okay, wow, that's quite a list. What about in other forms of art?
Here are some songs going into the public domain. Fats Waller, Ain't Misbehavin', great song, public domain. Gershwin's An American in Paris, so really captures the vibe of the city. That would be public domain. I just have to mention one more because love, 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 love this song. Bolero by Ravel. Let's talk about movies. So 1929 was a pivotal year for cinema because that's the year that sound films really replaced silent films. Alfred Hitchcock made his first sound film, Cecil B. DeMille, John Ford. Plus we get The Coconuts, which is the Marx Brothers' first feature film, which is fantastic.
Think of the opportunities here in Florida. 3 years ago, I came to Florida without a nickel in my pocket. Now I've got a nickel in my pocket.
That's all very well, Mr. Hammer, but we haven't been paid in 2 weeks, and we want our wages.
Wages? Do you want to be wage slaves? Answer me that.
No.
No, of course not. Well, what makes wage slaves? Wages.
So there are a lot of amazing films that will be public domain, and there's also cartoons. So last year, famously, the very first appearance of Mickey Mouse was public domain, but this year we get a dozen new Mickey Mouse films in which he wears his white gloves for the first time.
Ah.
And he also speaks his first words, which are...
Hot dog! Hot dog! Hot dog!
Hot dogs.
There's an intricacy that maybe you can explain to me here, because we said that Mickey Mouse, escaped copyright, got out of the house, but then more Mickey Mouse is escaping copyright. Why would the deadline arrive more than once for one character?
Oh, well, some characters like Mickey Mouse develop in copyrighted works over time. And so their first appearance 95 years ago may be in the public domain, but their subsequent appearances may be still copyrighted.
You didn't mention Popeye the Sailor Man yet, did you?
Oh, how could I not mention Popeye? So in terms of characters, some characters from comic strips that are going to be public domain in 2025, the big one is Popeye the Sailor.
But wait a minute. I think of Popeye as an animated feature. I guess that came later.
Yeah, that came a few years later. Yeah, initially he was in a comic strip called the Thimble Theater Strip, drawn by E.C. Segar. And I love, so his very first appearance, January 17th, 1929. So he's standing there on a deck. He's decked out, in a full sailor costume. He's got his pipe in his mouth. He's got the giant anchor tattoo on his forearm. And Castor Oil, who's Olive Oil's brother, comes up to him and says, "Hey there, you a sailor?" And Popeye's very first words, he says, "Just think I'm a cowboy?" So, you know, he's like sarcastic from the get-go, and he gets into fights all the time. But he also, and I think this is important and something I just discovered, he has a heart of gold. So the craziest thing we found with Popeye is 2 days before the stock market crash began, October 24th, 1929.
Uh-huh.
There's a comic strip in which Popeye is imploring Castor Oil, Olive Oil's brother, not to kick this poor farmer off of his land. You know, it's the farm where the farmer grew up, the only home he ever knew. And Popeye is just there like begging, please don't kick him off of his farm 2 days before the stock market crash began.
This is really newsy because if I'm not mistaken, I mean, the farm economy declined well before the stock market. So he's really commenting on what people are experiencing.
Right, right. And so this is what I love about these public domain works that we're talking about. It's a time capsule. It's a moment in history. It's a snapshot through the books, the movies, the comic strips, the music of our hopes and fears almost 100 years ago. And that's one of the many reasons to celebrate the public domain and maybe to learn from it, too. Because as you were saying, 1929 was quite a year. It's the end of the Roaring Twenties, the stock market crash that leads to the Great Depression. And rediscovering, opening this time capsule and looking at all of these works is really an incredible experience, and it really resonates with our current moment, surprisingly, as well.
Let's talk about the connection between art and creativity and the law, which is what this is theoretically a story about. I guess copyright law spurs creativity by making it more likely that artists can be paid for their work.
Absolutely.
Is there a new kind of creativity that is spurred by the copyright ending now?
Yes, indeed. So the public domain is like the yin to copyright's yang. So the yang are those rights that you just mentioned that spur and support creativity, but the yin is the public domain that ensures that artists have the raw material that they need to create in the first place. And I'd like to thank Christopher Nolan for making my point for me, because he just announced that he's making the star-studded mythic action epic version of Homer's The Odyssey coming out in 2026 using new IMAX technology. Homer's The Odyssey is a great example. And think about all the creativity that it has inspired, from James Joyce's Ulysses to the Coen Brothers' Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, to now this mythic action epic that sounds amazing coming from Christopher Nolan. So that's just one of the many examples of how the public domain is a built-in feature of the copyright system that works together with the copyrights in order to allow, promote, inspire creativity.
Jennifer Jenkins is co-director of Duke University's Center for the Study of the Public Domain. It's been a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much.
It's been a delight talking to you. Happy New Year. Happy Public Domain Day.
You're listening to Morning Edition from NPR News.
After the collapse of the Soviet Union, Germany welcomed about 200,000 Jewish refugees from the USSR. They brought cultural traditions with them, like partying hard during Christmas.
So just showing part of my culture and my friends accepting it, even like it a lot.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly, the rebirth of Soviet disco in Berlin, on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That story, plus the day's news from 3 until 6:30 on WPR.
This is WPR News.
It's Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks so much for being here. It's 8:29 on this Wednesday. News from NPR and WPR starts now.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Amy Held. In New Orleans, the suspect in this morning's mass casualty event is dead, according to the FBI, which is calling the attack an act of terrorism. His weapon was his pickup truck, say police. His victims, New Year's revelers, at least 10 were killed, 35 injured. After the suspect drove fast and intentionally around barriers and into people before exchanging gunfire with police, says Ann Kirkpatrick, police superintendent.
He was hell-bent on creating the carnage and the damage that he did.
Jimmy Cothran saw the carnage from above on a club balcony.
Some were very clearly deceased, but others were yelling out. And it's just, it's a lot to process.
Authorities say people should stay away from Bourbon Street as the FBI works to see whether improvised explosive devices found at the scene are viable. People are still encouraged, however, to attend today's Sugar Bowl college football game elsewhere in the city. Russian gas flowing through Ukraine and onto Europe has been halted. Kyiv refused to extend a five-year transit deal following Russia's full-scale invasion nearly 3 years ago. The European Commission says the EU has already reduced its dependence on Russian oil, and it has enough capacity to cope. This is NPR News.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:31. I'm Alex Crow. A Wisconsin village with 14 different zip codes has worked for years to get its own five-digit zip code. In 2024, the village of Summers and four other communities got as close as ever with a little help from Congress. There are around 10,000 people living in Summers right now, but for many, their addresses list them as residents of cities like Racine and Kenosha. Summers Village President Jason Peters says it's confusing, but also leads to higher insurance rates for some people. He says the village also loses out on vehicle registration fees for local road projects.
We actually go as far as, you know, we put it in our newsletter all the time. We've got a screen in our lobby that says, you know, when you go and register your car, to make sure that even though your address says Kenosha, that you put Summers down.
Summers and four other Wisconsin communities lobbied Congress for help. A bill designating unique zip codes passed the House but died in the Senate. However, Peters says that he's optimistic they can get it done in 2025. For the second straight year, Milwaukee has seen a decline in the number of homicides committed. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reports there were 140 homicides in the city in 2024. That's down from 172 homicides committed last year and 215 committed in 2022. This year's numbers are still above where they were before the pandemic started, however. In 2019, there were less than 100 homicides in the city. Non-fatal shootings were also down in Milwaukee this year. The Journal Sentinel reports there were 640 non-fatal shootings in Milwaukee. That's down 24% from the year before. The city of Delavan in Walworth County is building an ability-inclusive playground this year. The 13,000-square-foot project is called Never Say Never Playland. It will have wheelchair-accessible swings and a cushioned surface to protect kids from falls. Dusty Grinnis started the project in 2015 and has been fundraising and spreading the word ever since. She says it was all inspired by her daughter. She's raised more than $300,000 for the project, which will be located in a municipal park. The city is contributing the same amount of money, as well as building new bathrooms and a splash pad nearby. I'm Alex Crow. This is Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Faldin. Officials in the Caribbean nation of Trinidad and Tobago declared a state of emergency this week over a surge in gang violence. Under the state of emergency, the military can make arrests and it expands the powers of local authorities. Trinidad and Tobago reported more than 600 homicides this past year in a country of only around 1.5 million people. Joining us from the capital, Port of Spain, is Kejan Haynes, an editor with Guardian Media. Good morning and Happy New Year.
Hey, good morning. Happy New Year to you as well.
So what pushed Trinidad and Tobago's leaders to declare a state of emergency?
What we're learning is that over the weekend, last weekend, there was a specific murder that happened when gang leaders went to attack gang members went to attack a gang leader who went to a police station. As part of his bail conditions, he went to check in with the police station, and just they tried to kill him at that in that attack. The gang leader survived, but now what the police were saying was that there are going to be reprisals from his end to the other end. And what they were saying is that with these reprisals, they were going to be the use of very high-powered weapons, the AK-47s, AR-15s, and they were not going to care where these happened. So these people could have been targeted in public places, in the malls, in the streets, anywhere. And at that point, the authorities decided they needed a lot more powers to swoop in and get these weapons off the streets, out of the hands of the gang leaders.
And how are people reacting? I mean, on the one hand, I'm sure people want to be protected, but the state of emergency also greatly expands powers of law enforcement to do things like put roadblocks in the streets, search without warrants. I mean, how do people feel about this declaration?
Like many things, you're going to get a mixed reaction, and especially based on the political party that you support. If you support the government, you're all for the state of emergency. If you're for the opposition, you're tending to question it. But it's interesting because just a few days ago, the opposition people would have been calling for a state of emergency to deal with the crime situation. I think the most important thing with this state of emergency, as opposed to the others, there have now been five in the country. I've been alive for four of them.
Wow.
There's no curfew. And
okay.
When you think about this time of year, this is our time, this is carnival time. Yesterday would have been New Year's Eve. Everyone would have been going out and people were panicking about this, about a curfew, a possible curfew.
Right.
But with no curfew, life for the general public continues as normal. But if you are one of the people that the police are targeting, you are not going to have a good time the next couple of days.
So the state of emergency didn't put a damper on festivities on New Year's Eve?
And I think that's a major thing that is going to have people support this state of emergency a lot more. It is carnival time. A lot of activities happen at night around this time of year. People are going to want that. It's also an election year. We're officially supposed to have an election sometime this year. Having that would have been a nail in the political coffin.
And what happens now? I mean, is the state of emergency open-ended?
You have 15 days. The government has 15 days to go to Parliament to ratify it. And that gives them the right to continue it for 3 months. At the end of that 3 months, they can extend it again for another 3 months. Constitutionally, you cannot have a state of emergency in this country for more than 6 months. So we remain to see what time they end it.
Kejan Haynes is an editor with Guardian Media in Trinidad and Tobago. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
When a hurricane hit the southeast, mental health providers had a job to do, help their communities through a natural disaster while also living it. NPR's Katie Riddle spoke with therapists in Asheville, North Carolina.
Asheville is a town of bespoke creativity. Artists of all kinds reside here, as well as healers and helpers, therapists, chiropractors, massage. So when Hurricane Helene hit, the small army of mental health professionals here didn't hesitate. They knew they were needed badly. But the kind of therapy they've been practicing since the storm, many say it's like nothing they've done before, like Anne Dupree Rogers.
There's a therapy session where somebody has signed up, come in, may or may not be using their insurance to have a session with a therapist. That is not what has been happening since the hurricane.
Rogers is a licensed clinical social worker. She says in the days and weeks after Helene, she fell back on her basic training.
Helping people get food, water, find each other, and knowing sort of supportive things to say or not say during those times.
And yet, in the midst of that chaos, Rogers was also experiencing shock and trauma.
So when your thinking brain is what helps you plan and problem solve and organize and find your car keys and think about what you need to do next, when you're in survival mode, you can't really put all that together. So, I mean, this is a true story. I put dog food in the coffee maker instead of coffee. That was just like, just a moment of, yeah, this is real.
Roger says having these experiences alongside her patients, it's changed her.
I have more empathy than ever before. And that's a huge part of being a good supporter of others is empathy.
Two other therapists here are Jenny Sheely and Cynthia Sheely. They're sisters. Neither of them grew up here, but they both fell in love with the land and the people. Now they have their own separate therapy practices here. When Helene hit, they describe a dystopian shift in reality they experienced together.
No power.
Shared meals.
We shared meals. You don't have power. You don't have cell.
No access to information. No idea what was going on.
Yeah. And I rode to the river. Rode my bike to the river. Yeah. And we saw.
You showed us.
We saw the destruction.
Cynthia Sheely remembers looking out at her town for the first time. It was submerged.
That was really hard to stand on that bridge and see that water.
At the fire station that day, they saw a sign that said there was no way in or out of Asheville.
That was a lot.
I feel it right now.
I do too. Like, it was a lot to take in. We only had one lane open. We didn't have cell service.
This is what's happening with the storm. I think when you least expect it, it just sort of shows up. And this is what we're working with everybody with. Like, you don't know when it's going to show up.
They don't know when this trauma will show up, either with themselves or with their patients. These sisters say they are still feeling the storm's destabilizing impact with their patients weeks later.
When my clients came in, there was this look at each other and an immediate hug and a holding on, right? And I cried with people as they were sharing photos or their story.
Both these therapists say because of this experience, they've renegotiated boundaries with their patients. They're giving more of themselves. They're more in the room.
And that felt real. It felt authentic. And I definitely want more of that is how I want to practice.
Mostly, Hurricane Helene was a thief of lives, of land, and of health. But for these therapists, she did leave this one gift. Katie Riddle, NPR News, Asheville, North Carolina.
This is NPR News.
And this is Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. Thanks for being with us on this New Year's Day, the first day of 2025. It's also a Wednesday, by the way. We're still following the latest details out of New Orleans, where police say that 10 people were killed and more than 35 were injured after a driver plowed through a crowd on Bourbon Street celebrating New Year's Day. We'll have that story coming up in news about 18 minutes from now. Here on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Need a hand with that? Maybe Larry can help.
Larry Mueller here. We're taking a look at training your pet.
And see if you can manage your debt on your own.
There is an iPhone storage setting that you can go into. It will tell you how much storage each application on your phone is using.
And I found that incredibly helpful.
Great questions.
You can be a lot of things.
The Larry Mueller Show, weekday mornings at 11 on WPR News.
Support for WPR comes from Northern Sky Theater and Batch Bakehouse. Join the team of organizations that support a wide variety of informative and inspiring programs for the people of Wisconsin. More at WPR.org/sponsor.
I'm Gregory Berg, encouraging you to subscribe to the new Morning Show podcast, which can be found on all of the major podcast platforms, including Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Apple Podcasts, to receive a different morning show 7 days a week. Remember to search for The Morning Show with Greg Berg.
It's Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. At 8:44, here's what's happening in news. 10 people were killed and more than 35 were injured when a vehicle drove into a crowd on New Orleans' Bourbon Street in the first few hours of New Year's Day this morning. Emergency responders there also say the person who committed that attack has been killed. A blackout hit nearly all of Puerto Rico as U.S. territory prepared to celebrate New Year's Day, leaving more than 1.3 million people in the dark. Police are still searching for a person of interest after three people were found dead inside of a home in New Lisbon earlier this week. The police department there released a statement saying the investigation began June 29th when they got a call about a missing juvenile. That child was last seen with 47-year-old Virgil Thu, the man whom police now are searching for. This is Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from C3 AI. C3 Generative AI works to enable rapid access to traceable, hallucination-free insights from enterprises using any LLM, helping turn the invisible into the obvious. This is Enterprise AI. From Procter & Gamble, maker of Metamucil, a fiber supplement containing psyllium.
This is a monthly test of the Southeast and South Central Wisconsin Emergency Alert System. In the event of an emergency, this system would bring you important information. This test is now concluded.
That goes into making a great pot of stew.
A little while ago, when I was visiting my parents in Wisconsin, I found an old cookbook that I had purchased in France. I've been visiting my parents as an extended guest throughout COVID, journeying back and forth between Oshkosh and Chicago. Gratefully, my parents welcomed my ping-ponging across the state line with open arms. Come, stay as long as you'd like. Leave whenever you wish. I love cooking, and I quickly found that making home-cooked meals for my parents elicited oohs and ahs, and my stepdad's famous understated way of declaring that he loved a dish. He would say, "I could eat that again." Cooking was a very excellent way to express my gratitude. So I took that French cookbook and found a recipe for beef bourguignon. The next day, I made the pot of deep simmering broth, rich chunks of beef and vegetables and wine. My parents exclaimed how I was filling up the whole house with such rich smells. There is something indeed really special about filling up the house with a loving smell of simmering food. I am a foodie for sure, and I have found that it's a very sensual way of taking up all the space in the house. You put love into a pot, add a gentle flame, and then surrender to the process of transformation. And somehow, it fills up the whole house, this energetic field of nourishment and love of which I am a critical part. I love the meditation of cooking. You transform one thing into another. You take multiple ingredients, and somehow they turn into a unity that perhaps an onion and a carrot could not have otherwise imagined. Then, if you are lucky, you can share such love food with beloveds, and the deep aromas of stews that will linger in the house long after the meal is over. That's how love works. This resonance gently permeates so that the moment you open the front door, it greets you. Love, savory and nourishing, caressing you all, both unseen and everywhere. After hours of simmering, I declared that the meal was ready. My stepdad had set the table hours before in his wordless display of anticipation, so I poured the glasses of wine, reverently placed the food on the plates, and granted them to my parents with a flourish. To our stunned delight, my stepdad took his time eating. Usually, he inhales his food. Now he savored it, feeling the flavors in his mouth, tasting the thyme and the deep love it rested upon. My mom excitedly asked me questions about the recipe, the process. I told her what I could about the recipe, but the process? That's harder because it includes unnameable steps. Feeling into the timing of the food, knowing the exact moment the next step needs to begin, and infusing the recipe with love. Finally, as we sat back in our chairs, hands on our contented stomachs, my stepdad looked at me with sparkling eyes and said in his ritual exclamation, "I could eat that again."
Writer Crystal Chan brought you that story about the power of preparing a good meal. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Gregory Berg. The studios of WGTD will be closed from December 28th through January 1st for the holidays, and during that time there will be no morning show broadcast. But each and every day there will be a different morning show podcast episode for you to enjoy, with interviews drawn from the morning show archives. The podcast version of the morning show is available wherever you get your podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, but be sure to look for the right name, The Morning Show with Greg Berg.
It's morning edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. In weather for today, mostly cloudy. A few flurries are possible with high temperatures in the 20s and 30s. Overnight, clouds are expected to hang around. No precipitation, though, with low temperatures getting all the way down into the single digits and teens across the state. Tomorrow, a mix of sunshine and clouds with some snow in the north later on in the day with highs in the 20s. This is WPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Fadel. It's a common sight on Instagram. Millennial women in curated outfits sharing recipes, health tips, and parenting advice in spotlessly clean homes.
What you can expect is lifestyle content, food, lots of food.
Making a bone marrow whip is so incredibly easy. All you do is bake off the bones.
But some of these accounts are strategically spreading messages of hate. Lacey Lynn and Sensibly Shy are just two influencers who include anti-feminist and white nationalist views in their otherwise wholesome content.
Many of these women say they're eagerly anticipating Donald Trump's return to the presidency. Now, to be clear, not all accounts are the same. Not all traditional wives or trad wives, as they're sometimes called, are sharing bigoted content. But groups that track extremist movements say their ideologies are spreading and social media is key to recruitment.
To learn more, I spoke with Evian Leidig. She researches global extremism and has been an advisor to the U.S. Justice Department, the UN, and the Council for Europe. She's also a fellow with the International Center for Counterterrorism in The Hague. Her latest book is The Women of the Far Right. Leidig says that a lot of the people who follow these accounts are unaware of what they're looking at.
They come across this content and they don't often realize that it's leading them to this rabbit hole of much more extreme content.
Yeah, I mean, I can see how that happens because it was like looking at it, I'm like, oh, beautiful family, pretty. And then yeah. It's like, wait, where's this gun? And what'd she say about immigrants?
Yeah, exactly. So you picked up on the fact that there is a really diverse range of aesthetics. So that kind of cements in either the like 1950s suburban housewife and white picket fence, all the way to the hippie bohemian off the grid living homesteading aspirational lifestyle. But I think what unites these women is that they have very clear roles in terms of what they see as traditional gender divisions. And they also have a very strong opposition to feminism, regardless of the aesthetic that they promote on their accounts.
But is there anything dangerous about that? I mean, or is that just women preaching the life that they happen to be living?
So the moment that it does become problematic is when it gets tied into what they see as a white nationalist utopian vision for society. Mm. And this is when we start to see a lot of the white supremacist discourse come out, as well as quite a lot of coded language or subtle language. And it's not until you're actually immersed into this community that you actually start to pick up on those signals.
Now, if you could describe some of this coded language and the way that it leans into racist theories, anti-LGBTQ language, anti-immigrant views? I mean, how does that look?
So it often comes across in disappearing content like Instagram stories, which only lasts for 24 hours. They'll talk about LGBTQ individuals grooming young children in schools and in classrooms. We will also see a broad range of things like population replacement conspiracy theories. So this idea of the great replacement, for example, which is this notion that white people are being deliberately replaced by immigration in Western societies.
Is there a sort of coordinated effort going on here?
Well, I do think that there is a coordinated effort. A lot of these momfluencers were quite politically active in the so-called alt-right, which I noticed in the 2016 and 2020 elections. And for many of these influencers, they deliberately shifted towards posting about motherhood content because they wanted to showcase to their audiences what they hoped would be role models in terms of right-wing traditional families. So it really was a deliberate propaganda choice that they made.
These influencers are peddling in theories that end up being very, very dangerous. Is there anything being done about that?
There is unfortunately very little being done. These influencers are very adaptable. They know what is the gray area when it comes to being able to post content that sits just at that boundary between what is accepted and not accepted on these platforms. And at the same time, there is a gender blind spot when it comes towards recognizing the harms and the quite insidious role that these women do play on platforms.
Evian Leidig is the author of The Women of the Far Right. Thank you so much for your time and your insights.
Thank you.
NPR reached out to Meta, Instagram's parent company, for comment and did not receive a response in time for this broadcast.
This week's Billboard chart is filled with old Christmas records. Nat King Cole, Frank Sinatra, Bing Crosby, I'm Dreaming. But all the way at number one is a non-holiday album, which is something of an oldie itself. Stephen Thompson of NPR Music explains.
We owe SZA a great debt. Had she not surprise released a deluxe edition of her two-year-old album SOS just before Christmas, you'd currently be hearing about Michael Bublé's ageless, bloodless holiday album returning to number one. Instead, you get to witness the triumph of a terrific update of SZA's album. This new edition is titled SOS Deluxe, Lana. The new version of SOS has been supersized to the point of unwieldiness. It's got 15 new tracks, but it was a chart powerhouse even before its expansion. It debuted atop the Billboard 200 near the end of 2022, going on a run of 10 weeks as the most popular album in the country. It's never left the top 20 since its release. That's more than 2 years of chart relevance. 5 songs from the album have hit the top 10 in that time. The new deluxe edition of SOS sports a whopping 38 songs. That fresh round of streaming activity sent the album roaring back to number one. In the history of Billboard's main albums chart, no record has ever posted a longer gap between stints on top, and that's going back to 1956. Of course, it's a fairly recent development to have artists release their own deluxe editions of already successful albums, and on-demand streaming is a pretty recent development in its own right in the grand scheme of things. Still, Billboard did a bit of math and determined that if just those 15 new tracks had been released as a freestanding album, that would have hit number one anyway. Regardless, SZA has blocked Michael Bublé and other holiday titans from the top spot. A Christmas miracle. Stephen Thompson, NPR Music.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Alex Crow, and that'll do it for Morning Edition on this Wednesday here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks so much for making time for us today on New Year's Day. News is on the way.
Wisconsin Public Radio is a service of the Wisconsin Educational Communications Board and the University of Wisconsin-Madison, with additional financial support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and from listeners through the Wisconsin Public Radio Association.
WGTD.org is your portal to public radio, beginning with local news, station information, program schedules, old programs, and videos. WGTD.org includes links to NPR, Wisconsin Public Radio, and WGTD's Facebook page.
This is WGTD HD 91.1 Kenosha Resort.